You can't start the car. Johnny has the keys.
Hello, hello, and welcome out there in podcast and YouTube land. We hope that you are having an awesome day and you have reached Johnny Has the Keys, a podcast and YouTube channel where we talk about horror movies, science fiction movies, those particular genres, key elements that influenced those particular movies of the week or the episode, and things that they in turn influenced down the road. If you're joining us for the first time, wow, great. We would love to know how you heard about us. How did you find out about Johnny? Did you just stumble on us? Somebody recommend us? Whatever. Let us know in the comments down there or send us an email on it. We'd also like you to do, you know, the typical things that all podcasters and YouTube channelers ask for, you know, subscribe so you know what new episodes are coming out, but also give us a like, give us a review, go to Apple and say, hey, these guys are awesome. We would love that and appreciate that. Those of you who are tuning in again, welcome back. We hope that you'll have a good time with us today as well. My name is David. I'm here with my good friend Tim. Tim is in a haunted house and I have a bunch of posters behind me. So how are you, Tim? How's it been going this week?
I'm doing well. I noticed one of those posters back there is Avatar, and I was wondering about that because I know it's your favorite movie.
Oh, it is. Let me do this. I'll just do this the entire episode. So you just see good stuff instead of the bad stuff,
okay,
or whatever. Right. But yeah. But no, it's not that every one of these is not necessarily a great movie either. Although, you know, War of the Satellites, probably not a good movie. You know, but some of them are good. I just found this.
Yeah, there's Destination Moon. We talked about it last week.
No, we did not talk about Destination. We talked about the first men in the moon.
I know, but it was a key.
It was a key.
For sure.
Yeah.
What have I been doing?
What have you been doing?
I digressed. As usual, in the corridors of Shudder, I watched a movie that may sound familiar to you. It's called Evil Dead Trap.
Evil Dead what?
It is called Evil Dead Trap.
Okay.
Yeah. This movie, you know what? I don't even have a date on it. I think it came out in 1989, though. It was you know, I could look that up. I'm just a bad host here. I'm pretty sure it was the end of the 80s. Yeah, it was 1988.
Sure.
This movie got 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. So naturally, it was a beacon that said, Tim, you must watch this.
You and these tomatoes.
Well, let me tell you what. I don't get it with this one at all. It's a Japanese movie. And, you know, we talk about this, and we'll probably talk about this next week with our film next week, how sometimes you just have to let some foreign cinema flow over you because of, you know, whether it's a cultural difference or whether it makes sense because of some reason we're unaware of. This movie made no sense to me at all. It was so crazy. It was directed by a guy named Toshiharu Ikeda, also written by him. He's a prolific in Japanese cinema. He's prolific, but no movies I'm familiar with. And, of course, the cast is Japanese as well. So, and there is one person in the cast that has done an American film. Her name was Miyuki Ono. She was in that movie Black Rain. You remember that? That Ridley Scott film?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, she was in that, but that's the only connection to anything that we are familiar with. A brief synopsis, a late night TV presenter receives a snuff tape in which a woman is brutally murdered. She decides to take a crew out to the location indicated in the tape, but only death and despair await them. it's very much a slasher movie, and it's very gory, very gory. So I thought, well, maybe because of its slasher origins, this is why it ranked highly on Rotten Tomatoes. I don't know why that would be.
Okay.
But then there's one moment in the film, and, you know, spoiler alert for those of, you know, a 30-year-old film, but one of the people that's like raping and killing this woman says, he will free me from his hold if I murder for him. And she's like, him. And he's like, well, him within him. And I was like, what the fuck does that mean? And then later on in the movie, as like the final girl confronts the killer, there's like this tumor thing inside this guy that comes out, and it's like this mutant baby murderer thing. I mean, this movie is all over the board. So,
okay.
I would recommend it if you are bored and just want to see something really crazy and out there and don't mind subtitles. Otherwise, I would not recommend this movie, even though Rotten Tomatoes thinks highly of it. So,
okay.
So, Evil Dead Trap, which I'm sure is the American title. I have no idea what the Japanese title is.
Evil Dead Trap. Okay.
Evil Dead Trap.
I did not do that much from a genre perspective. However, I did revisit something old. It was going to bed the other night, and I thought, okay, I'll just watch something. What can I watch? Oh, let's look around and see what pops up. And for some reason, I'd been thinking about Twilight Zone. I don't know if it was because I was thinking about writing or something with writing, because I've always respected Serling and doing those twists and everything else. Maybe it was because we had been talking last week or last episode, we talked about First Men in the Moon, and it has that awesome little kind of twist ending to it, that very Robert Blocky, like you had said, end. That was different, you know, kind of thing. And so maybe it was because of that. I don't know. But anyway, I decided to revisit two episodes and ended up, of course, just because I was drawn to it, I had to do Nightmare at 20,000 Feet because it's, you know, our buddy William Shatner. And he's the one that sees the gremlin on the wing and all of that. It turns out I'd forgotten this or repressed it or whatever. That episode was directed by Richard Donner. Who did?
Oh, yeah. You know. That doesn't surprise me at all.
Had Superman earlier this season, and Richard Donner was in that. But I followed that up with, you know, one of my favorites and had to look for it because, you know, is it a favorite or whatever? The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street. Mm-hmm. I think that is probably – I don't know if I can say it's my favorite Twilight Zone episode, but it's up there. I'd probably be in my top three, I would think. Just because.
Is that Serling or Matheson? I can't remember.
Good question. I honestly don't know.
It's Serling. I don't remember it being a Matheson short story.
I remember it is a Serling.
Yeah. I mean, he did like To Serve Man and Born of Man and Woman, but I don't think he did The Monsters on Maple Street.
But the subtext in Maple Street of this whole, you know, be careful who your friends are because they won't be your friends when there's panic and fear and everything else. It's that whole, you know, you've talked about it too with Walking Dead. You know, it's not the monsters you're afraid of. It's the humans, you know, and this, I think, is the first precursor to all of that. This story of, under threat of survival, humans will become basic animals, and they will hurt friends, they will deny family, they will do whatever to survive, and because fear rules them at that time, kind of thing. And it was such a cool story to see again, and I hadn't watched it in years and years and years, and yeah, Claude Akins is in it, and I mean, it's got a good cast.
I remember Claude Akins being in it.
Yeah, because he's a good villain in it, even though he's, you know, the nice guy, but he's a good villain in it.
It was written by Rod Serling. I just looked it up.
Okay, but Jack Weston is in it. I mean, it's got a great cast and really cool build to it. And it's one of those where the twist at the end is you see coming, not just now, because a lot of, you know, when you watch Twilight Zone now, it was, what, 70 years ago or whatever. So a lot of it is predictable now just because we're so used to twists and fantasy elements in our cinema. But this one, the twist at the end is what you projected. It's what you predicted. It'll turn out to be a false alarm and you guys are acting like total dicks. And yeah, it's exactly what happens at the end. You go, see, I told you.
Right. You well, know? It's almost like writer's education. You know, we've seen the films and stories similar so much now that we anticipate the ending. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, even at the time
back then, but not.
But even at the time, I think Serling fell into it. You know, he fell into this whole writing thing of, all right, so what's the final twist? Before I even write this episode, what am I going to set up and then twist at the end? And that came kind of predictable when you were watching those latter Twilight Zone seasons and stuff, because it became so much so of, you know, oh, the librarian who wants to be alone. There's a Holocaust. He's alone. Oh, breaks his glasses. Can't read. Oh, yeah. You know.
And that's a Robert Block. Yeah.
Yeah. But that I
don't know if he wrote that, but that's a Robert Block twist for sure.
Oh, yeah. For sure. For sure.
Yeah.
But I did think it was, you know, even, you know, just now as I was talking about it, I suddenly thought, okay, well, that's kind of a cool segue too, because it's all talking about fear and what you think is happening isn't really happening, and people will degenerate into monsters sometimes. Monsters are coming, kind of thing. And that's a, you know, kind of a good segue to what we're talking about today.
One big monster.
One big monster.
In particular, that may be actually the face of a bigger monster, according to this film anyway. What we are discussing, for those of you that don't already know, is a little movie that came out in 1994 called New Nightmare. The first thing I want to say about this movie is, when this movie came out, it was called Wes Craven's New Nightmare. Mm-hmm. And somewhere along the line, they have dropped Wes Craven from the title. And I'm not sure when that happened.
Do you think he died and Shay went, I want all the rights back again? Or whatever?
I don't know. But I have a box set, a Freddy Krueger box set from 1999. Uh-huh. And the DVD copy of this movie in there is entitled Wes Craven's New Nightmare. So they were still calling it that 5 years later.
Well, I thought it was interesting because in looking it up and trying to do a little, I just did a little research on this because I figured you'd roll with this one. But it was New Nightmare. It wasn't Wes Craven's New Nightmare. And I was thinking, well, that's weird because it's John Carpenter's The Thing. I mean, when you can look up John Carpenter's with an S and The Thing pops up. If you look up Wes Craven's, you get, here's a director who did such and such, and da da da. I went, what about New Nightmare? Wasn't that his?
Well, so, and anyway, it's also a play on him, because he talks in this movie about writing scripts based on his dreams.
Yep.
So it makes sense to be called Wes Craven's New Nightmare. John Carpenter just had an ego. He was putting his name on every film.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, of course. Mean,
there, John Carpenter's Ghost of Mars, John Carpenter's Vampires.
But, you know, I hadn't thought of that. Wes Craven's New Nightmare, that's what this subtext of this entire movie is.
And the whole movie's meta-influence, so makes sense. So when I list this on our website, or when I list this in my notes, it's like, what do I call it? I'm not really sure.
Wes Craven's New Nightmare, God.
Well, that's what I've been doing, but I just noticed that, I mean, even on IMDb, it's just called New Nightmare now. Isn't that strange? I find it strange. Yeah,
I did. I found that strange, too. Like I said, in looking up stuff, that's what I found, was it was called New Nightmare.
All right. Well, first of all, a brief synopsis. I don't have one.
I'd be curious to see how you do this synopsis.
First of all of you out there know, most of you out there know that I'm a Freddy Krueger enthusiast. He is probably my favorite of all the slasher villains. We have covered A Nightmare on Elm Street, the original, on this show. As a matter of fact, this is the third Wes Craven we've covered, I believe, because we covered Nightmare and we also covered Scream. This movie predates Scream by 2 years. And it is basically a very original concept where Wes said, hey, let's do, Yeah, sure, I'll do a new Freddy movie, but I want to do something different. Let's bring him into the real world and cast the actors involved in the first film as themselves. And mm-hmm. I thought, wow, I mean, that's pretty genius. So basically you have Heather Langenkamp, who's debating on whether or not to do a new Nightmare on Elm Street sequel. And Wes, you're right. How am I going to do the synopsis? Wes is having dreams about a larger demoniac entity that perhaps could escape into the real world if the film franchise it was based on ended. And so when, you know, the last movie before this with Freddy in it was called Freddy's Dead.
Right.
And Wes's idea was, well, what if that releases the real demon into the world and he just manifests himself as or itself as Freddy Krueger and goes after the people? And basically, we need to make a new Nightmare movie or this is not going to stop.
Right.
Does that make sense? If you're confused, it's because this movie is very... Well, it's very meta, for one thing. It's not a perfect movie by any means, but I see moments of brilliance in this movie that I think carried forth into his next feature, which was Scream.
Oh, definitely.
What is your first experience with New Nightmare?
My first experience with New Nightmare was the other evening when I watched it for the first time. I'd never seen it before. Again, I'm not the enthusiast you are of Freddy. I did like Nightmare a lot, the original. I remember seeing two of the sequels and not liking them. Even Dream Warriors, although I thought it had some concepts I liked, I didn't like what they were doing with Freddy. You know, they were
right.
They were comedifying, and that to me, you know, I struggle with comedy horror. I like Evil Dead, but I don't like the remake or Evil Dead 2 sort of thing. So this was my first experience. I agree with you. I don't think it's a perfect movie. I did enjoy watching it, but I think it falls into my could have been's. It falls into my I wish you hadn't rushed and maybe spent a couple, a year or so in rewrites. Love the fact that you
key element.
Love the fact that you got so many people back so that those references could have worked. You know, those references worked because you're literally, especially in the, it's kind of a segue to scenes, but especially in the confluence scene, the one where John Saxon shows up as John Saxon, but within like three or four lines, he's suddenly Nancy's father. And calling
her Nancy instead
and
of
then
Heather.
Ends up his yeah. entire wardrobe changes and his car changes and suddenly we realize, oh, they've overlapped. We're now it's combined, you know.
Yeah, that's what I mean by sheer brilliance. I was like, oh, that was great.
Yeah.
You know, but then they'll do something, you know, a little cheesy or something, a little stupid.
Well, so I liked that, but so again, I agree with you. I think it's there's some concepts in it that are brilliant, but they're not as executed as they should be. And they're surrounded by stuff that just doesn't propel the story or ask, you know, with me, especially it gets me asking too many questions. You know, I have like just a list of questions for you from this episode about why this, okay. What about this? What does this mean? Da, 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 you know.
Well, you touched on what I think the flaw in this movie is, and that's the screenplay.
Yeah.
And I do think it should have been further developed, and I think a lot of that's Wes's fault. I mean, he wrote the screenplay, but when he did Scream 2 years later, Kevin Williamson wrote that screenplay, and it was just a slam dunk. I mean,
oh, it was brilliant.
A home run.
So, you can definitely see the influence. So a key from this movie is definitely Scream because this sets right. up that whole meta feel, that whole feel of movie within a movie making fun of itself, literally making fun of itself.
Right.
Kind of thing.
And I mean, Nightmare on Elm Street is by far my favorite movie as far as Freddy movies. It used to be that the one you mentioned, Dream Warriors, was probably the second. because I love the whole superhero aspect of it and all the kids having different powers in their dreams and stuff. But now the reason we haven't covered it is because I'm scared to watch it again. I really feel like it's going to suck.
Yeah, I could understand that.
And even Wes said when doing this movie, his original idea for the third movie was this concept. And the studio rejected it. And they basically turned Freddie into a comedian and took other aspects of his screenplay and just ditched this whole concept. Because Wes did co-write Nightmare on Elm Street 3.
Okay.
So that's part of the original. And speaking more, a little bit of background before we go into scenes, the movie was budgeted at $8 million. It made $20 million, you know, so it was a hit, but not a hit. I mean, it didn't, you know, rock anybody's world. It just made its money back in a profit. The working title was Nightmare on Elm Street 7, The Ascension, because they were trying, I'm sure Bob Shea was trying his best to work it into the whole oeuvre of Freddy. And Wes was like, no, we're going to call it something that's not got Elm Street in it at all.
Right.
Yeah. What else have I got? We don't see Freddy's face for a very long time in this movie, and there were none in the trailers, apparently. I don't remember. Good. I haven't looked at the trailer in a while.
Yeah, because that would pseudo confuse people. They may think, oh, this is not a Freddy movie. It's a new nightmare. This could be cool. Another monster, another killer, another demon, or whatever.
Right. Some of the movie elements are real that I find this fascinating. You know, he started talking about a demon coming into the world because of the Freddy movies ending. There were major earthquakes in LA in 1994.
Mm-hmm.
So they incorporated them into this film. And I associate that, if you have a question about it, with the coming of this presence or whatever. But I love the shock of some of the earthquake scenes in this movie. And a lot of the stuff you see when she is driving is real.
The big California quakes came like 2 weeks after they finished principal photography, and they sent people out to shoot them so he could have it for the edits.
They did.
And I always got the okay. As I was watching it, I definitely got the impression that the earthquakes would end up being the excuse for some of the stuff that was happening, like him saying, I cut my finger because of the mirror that broke or whatever. But also be the coming of whatever. At that point, I thought the coming of Freddy. Freddy's about demon. To bust out sort of thing. Yeah. It reminded me, a big key for me is Buffy. It reminded me of like, oh, you guys have suddenly, you're living on the Hellmouth kind of thing. And the demons are going to rise.
I hadn't even thought about that.
That was a big key for me from it. But then they didn't really play off of that. Again, a screenwriting thing. That doesn't wrap up anywhere. Right. There is not no really. And again, it's the same
it
thing.
It becomes Deus Ex Machina.
I really loved the scene with Wes and Heather Langenkamp talking about, you know, the nightmare. There is a demon in my nightmare. In the story, he can be trapped in a story. That's the only, like a genie in a bottle, she says, and all that. It was a really cool scene. I just wanted more. Like, why didn't he go ahead and name the demon and give us, like, here's a reference. Here's who I see in my nightmare.
So it gives it a little bit more validity, like in a text or something. Yeah.
Correct. Yeah, and visually, so that by the end of it, we're actually seeing Freddy being destroyed by the demon. The demon now kills Freddy and becomes the demon, and that's who she's fighting, rather than it being Freddy. Because that's kind of the thing, is that he even says a darker demon has taken Freddy's form. And I went, oh, okay, so that's kind of a great concept.
It is.
It just isn't there enough, I think. And they end up going for some of the old Freddy jokes at the end, like, you know, the tongue thing, I didn't get the tongue thing at all or care or like. I got the one on the phone. That was great. And I went, okay, that's how you do an homage. You pick up the phone. Right. He says the line licks her again, you know.
Or when the little kid, what's his name? Dylan.
Dylan.
Is in the furnace and his arm starts stretching to reach for it. Yeah. That's a good homage too. Yeah.
But, and that'll get to my big thing about this movie. It's shown so clear and so precise and so well lit that it wasn't scary to me. The cinematography in this movie is so precise and great and good in a way that it takes away from the scary movie to me. Does that make sense? It's kinda, so well.
I just didn't really notice it.
You know, what made like the Freddy homage is the arm, you know, stretching and going out and getting Dylan. It's kind of like the scene in the original when his, you know, she's having the dream, the first girl, Lindsay, or no, that's Halloween. And Nancy, no. Anyway, the blonde girl in the original.
Tina.
Is having the nightmare and sees him and he stretches his arms out and they go all the way to the sides. That's kind of like dark. That, but that's very dark and shadowy and everything in this is very down to the fact that I don't like his makeup in this. It's too precise and too clear and too nice looking. There's no goo on it or blisters. It looks like, oh, he's got things around his eyes and they're so perfect and it's great. And I don't know if he was going toward, is that more of a demon look and not a burned old man who's a serial killer? You know what I mean? Because it's so symmetrical. It's so demonic. It's so straight on kind of look as opposed to in past Freddy movies, I guess, or in the original.
Well,
in
the first movie, he really looks like pizza face. I mean,
yeah, he's a burned
it's very shoddy makeup, but it's scary.
Yes.
Then Kevin Yeager took over in the second movie, and then it started looking very rubbery.
And see, stretchy. I thought this one looked really rubbery and really
bad. I like this one better. I like this one. This would be my second favorite, like I said, next to the first film.
It's yeah.
In many aspects, even the makeup. I do think that shot behind me, I do think it looks a little too clean. Like he has a green hat instead of a brown hat.
Yep.
And his sweater is very clean and he has a green trench coat. And like you said, it may be overlit and he doesn't look
scary. It is. It's overlit. Yeah. There's no atmosphere in it. There's no fog or anything else. We don't feel like we're in a dream sequence. We feel like we're here, which may be what Wes wanted. You know, that may be a choice that he made, obviously.
Yeah, I'm sure it was.
But to me, it's too clear. It's not, it's very well executed from a cinematic standpoint. I just don't think it's atmospheric enough. Does that make sense?
Gotcha.
You know, I called it the temple, wherever they were at the end. In the nightmare world.
Down into hell or whatever.
Yeah. Again, everything there, very well lit, very pretty, very perfect. The fire looks great over here. That torch looks excellent, but I don't see any smoke come from that torch. I don't see any atmosphere. I don't see any texture. It looks nice, clean, and precise and pretty. And I went, I guess I like my horror kind of more dirty and murky. You know, that's the way I
can
roll.
Relate. I was talking about things that in the background of this movie that also helped inspire it, and I mentioned those earthquakes, but also Heather was the victim of a real stalker. I don't know.
Yeah,
if you knew
I didn't
that.
Know that. No. I saw some sentence about it.
Yeah, she went on to do. I tried my damnedest to find information on it, and I can't find anything. So they're keeping it. I guess the court keeps those records from being out there or something. I don't know. But I do know that it was she had been doing a lot of television after Nightmare on Elm Street. I also found out she was an extra in The Outsiders and Rumblefish. Did you know that?
No.
Yeah,
she was in The Outsiders?
That's how she got started. And then she was working as something. I can't remember. She was working somewhere and saw the auditions for Nightmare and she went for it and got it. But anyway, after Nightmare, she didn't do a lot of movies. She did a lot of television and she was on a show called Just the 10 of Us. And when that show got canceled is when the stalker showed up. That's all I know.
Okay.
So Wes asked her if she would mind him working that into the screenplay. And she said, no, that's fine. So she agreed to it, which I thought was kind of brave on her part because I don't know how serious it was. But
yeah.
Before we move on to scenes, I just want to say one other thing that sucks in this movie besides the fact that the screenplay is not complete. And that is the incidental music. Oh, my God. Any scene that is not scary has 1980s television music in it.
Yes. Yeah, I agree with you.
Horrible. Yeah. I was like, where did he get this canned music crap? Yep. Now, the stuff that's scary, you know, when they start floating in the Nightmare on Elm Street theme or it gets dark and creepy, that's all great. It's just like when Heather's driving around looking at earthquake stuff, it sounds like Beretta or Starsky and Hutch. I'm like, what the hell is going on?
That should be the subtitle for this episode. Sounds like Beretta.
It was terrible. So I knew that I was waiting for you to get to it because I knew you were going to. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the incidental music, terrible. All right. Before we move on, do you want to talk about any particular scenes? I agree with you that the tongue scene is a little ridiculous.
There's a fine line between paying homage to a previous iteration of your story and then just ripping it off and playing it up too much. And, you know, you and I have talked about that in several movies that have sequels that have tried to do stuff. I think this one probably is incredibly good at paying homage to the original without it feeling cheesy or stupid or bad. Those homages, when they happen, work and have purpose. It's like we talked about the arm coming out, trying to get Dylan and, you know, Freddie can't get there. So he stretches that arm all the way out, almost, you know, like 6 feet or something. Looks great. At the same time, Heather is trying to get to them and she's doing that whole my feet are in pudding thing again, which is just like trying to go up the stairs at home.
Right.
From the original, which was a great kind of homage back.
Callback.
The line, yeah. Screw your past. As soon as it happened, I had to pause and laugh because I thought of you. I said, I'll bet Tim is bursting out laughing right now going, yes, you know.
I love all the that nurse is like evil. woman that's like trying to keep her from her kid and like calling social services or whatever. I'm like, oh, my God. I mean, she even looks mean.
The nurse or the doctor? The doctor I really
like. The doctor. I guess it's it's not the nurses, it's the doctor, the African-American woman. Yeah.
And I guess it's not scenes, but it is overall, because it affects so many scenes. I like the fact that Wes misdirects us in certain casting or looks or interpretations so that we don't know if people are good or bad. So like the limo driver, he's a creep. It's really weird and creepy. And you start thinking, okay, is that Freddy? Is he a monster? Is he a demon? Is that a bad guy? Is he going to come back at the end? Or, you know, whatever. It's just the way he's played. The same thing with, what's her name? The babysitter, Julie or Janice or whatever, the babysitter.
That ends up being like the, a hybrid final girl. Yeah.
Well, yeah, because you get the impression he lingers on her face a couple of times and you're going, is she thinking something? Is she mean? Is she actually? She's a Freddy Plant. Oh, yeah. She's really a demon or something. Yeah. You know, and then she ends up being, what's her name? Tina. And that's another homage because that whole set went upside down. So, right. So they did the whole die on the ceiling thing again, like they did with Tina. Right. So that was a good one. And the same thing with, of course, with Dylan in several places. But even with that doctor that you had, there are times when there's kind of a menace in her voice.
Oh, yeah.
And it's not just, for sure, I'm going to take care of you. It's, I know stuff you don't know. And I'm, but it turns out it's because she suspects that she might be schizophrenic too, sort of thing. But
it's almost, it's very much meta, like this film.
Yes.
Where she could potentially be a supernatural menace, but she is definitely a real-life antagonist.
Agreed. Same thing with setting up the other two nurses. When they come in, you're going, okay, they're bad. Some, whatever they're doing is bad. They're going to hurt Dylan.
And they
they're
do the strap old switcheroo. As far as scenes for me, three things stick out. One is not a particular scene, but any scene that has an original cast member in it, like with her. Like when she's talking to Robert Englund on the phone, even though Wes Craven cannot act, the scene you mentioned where he tells her about the demon and his idea for this concept, the scenes with John Saxon, all of those, anytime you see the original gang back together, it's great.
Yeah. Hey, well, and Wes Craven, much better than the girl that played Julie or the babysitter or whatever. She's terrible. She's just terrible.
Oh, you think so? I think Wes Craven is awful. And the only one worse than this to me is Robert Shay. He is the worst. Okay,
that's one of my first questions for you. Is that really Robert Shay? I didn't look it up in the credits.
Everybody is in it. And Lynn Shay, who played the teacher in the original, is a nurse with like a single line in the movie too.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And also one of the producers or executives, one of the executives at Noon on Cinema, I'll get to it when we get to casting, plays herself too. Oh, okay. There's a lot of people playing themselves in this movie, especially at New Line Cinema.
I thought Englund did a great job. He showed a warmth and a charm, but then he got into a little bit of the creepy, but it felt like a personal creepy, not a Freddy creepy, which leads to another thing that I think is a huge miss in this movie. Robert Englund should have died or been killed or something should have happened to him.
I agree. I will go even further than that. And I know that listeners out there are going to get tired of me beating this dead horse. Really wish this movie could have been a 10-episode Netflix series because they could have done a single episode with each one of them. And it would have been fabulous, especially if they killed Robert Englund and his.
Yeah, if Flanagan had taken over it, maybe. But yes, that sort of thing.
Right.
I also kept thinking, okay, since they didn't, because, the husband dies. Then she finds out through the news article that the two other special effects guys had died prior to her husband. They just found their body. So, okay, people are dying. And then, they show Englund with that scene where he's painting Freddy. He's painting a nightmare, essentially. So I was thinking, they're going to kill Englund. That's going to be cool. And then they didn't. So by the finale, I'm thinking, he's going to show up. He's going to be part of the rescue.
They didn't
and
use
he
him
didn't.
Enough.
And I went, what the? What? That's a great opportunity.
It's funny. I keep saying they didn't use him enough. And he is Freddy in the movie. So obviously he's in the movie. But wanted to see more of him as himself.
Yeah, I think, think of this, because I had this idea after I watched it. It would have been cool. Dylan's almost dead. Nancy can't get to him. Heather can't get to him. Robert Englund shows up, starts fighting Freddy. We think he's killed Freddy. Then that turns into the demon that kills Robert. And suddenly, now we've got Heather and Dylan against the demon, not against Freddy. And that would have been so, I was going, Wes, why didn't you call me?
Too many people in this movie are dead now. Obviously.
Sadly, yes.
Mother is dead. John Saxon is dead. Wes Craven is dead. But if they could have brought this back as a series, I think it would have been fabulous with this concept to go more in depth, like you said, because the screenplay needs to go more in depth and do an episodic thing. I think it would be awesome.
Well, you get on the horn with that Netflix people right now. Have their people call your people.
I'll get to something about Nightmare's future in the keys, but that's
what about that scenes? You were on idea. Scenes. I'm sorry.
Two more scenes. Yes. Well, I mentioned anything with the original actors together. Just love seeing them together. Another scene is the scene on the talk show where they surprise her by Robert Englund being a guest. And they do that whole commentary on why would people hold in high regard a murderer, and they do that pan, and the people chanting Freddy. I mean, it's stuff you and I have talked about in the past.
Tim, why would you? Why would you idolize a horrible knife-wielding serial killer? I mean, child molester is what they called him. Yeah, this is God.
He's God.
No. Yeah, I loved that. I thought that commentary was really good, too, because it wasn't it was like the children that were chanting, Freddy. And I was like, oh, my God. And England's loving it. And he's doing the whole, yay, aren't I cool?
And everybody's out there wearing Freddy masks and in Freddy sweaters. And then when they leave, terrifying. I even love Heather afterwards. She's like, no, it's okay, but why didn't you let me know? Why didn't you call? You know,
see, because I have that same amount of uncomfort when I see a bunch of people in mega hats worshiping the prior president. You know, it makes me feel scared too. It's the same thing. Yeah. You know, terrified. Why are you why do you like this person? I don't understand. Morally reprehensible. And you are going, yeah, I love it.
Okay. And then my last scene is the funeral scene of her husband. Love that. It's also obviously got John Saxon for the first time, I think, and it's got Robert Englund in it.
There was also the other kid was there too.
A brief picture of Rob. Shot of Rob from the first film. Yeah, he is in there. And they were going to have others, but there were either conflicts or people just wouldn't commit. And I'll get to that in casting. I love the funeral scene. I love the scene in the talk show, and I love any scene where the guys are back together. Like, what's
I have to say that the question that the funeral scene generated for me, because Wes is really good in most of this with not telegraphing, but letting us know, suddenly now we're in the dream. We are in somebody's nightmare, whether it's Wes's or Heather's or Dylan's or somebody's nightmare. Somebody is asleep. And my question when I watched it at the funeral was, who's asleep? Who's asleep at the funeral? And there isn't an answer. Nobody is. So how does Freddy there digging out of the grave and taking Dylan and doing all this stuff? Because nobody's asleep. So
because he's coming into the real world.
No, that's not. I don't know.
You're making it up. I thought it was Dylan. Is it not Dylan?
Mm-mm. Remember, Dylan's being dragged by Freddy into the casket.
And she has to dive in Dylan and get him. Is Dylan at the funeral? No, he is at the funeral.
He's right beside her, sitting there. And remember, his whole thing is sleep deprivation.
Okay, then it was Wes. Wes was asleep. They just didn't cut that scene.
He just napped. He was just napping in the back during the funeral.
Let me tell you what, though. That scene is probably some of the scariest stuff in the movie. When she's in that grave and her husband comes to life and starts whispering in her face, and then she sees the hole go deep, and Freddie is pulling her son down by his feet. Yeah. I love that. I was like, this is right out of a great horror movie.
Yes. So that was a great horror scene. It was a good element. Especially just adding stuff like her husband is bleeding from his eyes and his mouth. You know, that just little touches like that make it even more scary.
And kind very of Dawn of the Dead makeup too.
Very bluish. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with you. I do like that scene. I think that scene is well done. It just raised questions for me about, I don't know what the mechanics of the movie are now. And maybe that was intentional, you know?
Maybe. I think that's all I have as far as scenes. Did you have any other things before I move to casting?
Nope.
Okay. I've got a few notes on casting. One is he originally had intended to ask Johnny Depp to come back and be in this movie. But it says he never had the courage to do it. I guess because Johnny was the only one that rose to superstardom after the first film.
Of course.
And later he ran into Johnny and said, that he was afraid to ask him to do it. And he said, I don't know why not. He said, I would have done it. He said, I definitely would have done it.
Wow.
I'm like, see, damn, that
that's
sucks.
A miss. That's a miss there. Yeah.
The role of Julie, who is played by an actress you don't like, obviously.
Yeah, no.
Two other women were considered for this role. Would you like to know who they are?
I would love to know who they were because both of them would have been better.
Well, one of them was Winona Ryder.
Oh, yes. Much better.
And the other was Drew Barrymore.
Oh, well, he got to use her for screen,
in the very next film. Right.
Wow. But Drew would have been really good in this part. That would have been great for her.
The only thing is I think that by putting a real known actress in that role, it would have taken us more out of the film. Because everyone else is playing themselves. So if you put Drew or Winona in there, I think it would have been jarring.
Without calling them Drew or Winona.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Yeah, for sure.
Both of these actresses turned down the offer due to prior commitments. However, Ryder had auditioned for the role of Kristen in A Nightmare on Elm Street 3, which was, I believe, the Patricia Arquette role. I would have loved to have seen her in that. Although Patricia Arquette's fine. And, of course, Wes Craven later directed Barrymore in Scream.
Mm-hmm.
Another actress was considered for the role of Julie. And you'll be like, ooh, this is great.
Okay,
and you wouldn't have recognized her at the time.
Okay.
Angelina Jolie.
Ooh.
Because, you know, she had done that HBO movie about the model.
Mia.
I don't think she was really on the map yet in 1994.
No, she would have been
Girl Interrupted had not come out yet.
Yeah.
She would have been
good. That would have been a win. Yep.
Yeah. Did you know?
No.
I mean, we already know they're playing themselves. But did you know that Heather Langenkamp is really married to a special effects guy?
No. Really? Oh, okay. That's meta.
Yeah. His name is David Leroy Anderson. And they had a son named Daniel. I'll talk about that later. But anyway, David Leroy Anderson did not want to play himself. And it's probably a good thing because he probably couldn't act. But,
yep.
I mean, he did a lot of Nightmare on Elm Street movies. He did Pet Sematary. He met her on the set, I think, of Pet Sematary, or proposed to her on the – I'll get to that. I've got that in my notes somewhere, too. I know I did.
Okay.
But, yeah. So they met behind the scenes, and he is a special effects thing artist. Miko Hughes, who plays Dylan. Her son.
Yeah.
Do you recognize him?
Yeah, he's Gabe. I recognized him immediately. Gage. Yeah, he's Gage from Pet Sematary.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
So we have he was a child actor. I think he's still in films. I think he's continued to act his whole life. He may be in like
so he got television. To be Gage and Dylan. That's pretty pretty good cred there for him.
Right.
I mean, he's a little over the top in this, but that's because of the script makes him that way. Yeah. But
right. Yeah. Yeah. There's moments where it's a little overacting, I would say.
Yeah. Where you can see Linda Blair in the background going, no, too much. Pull back a little bit. No.
I have a little story about Miko that is kind of creepy.
Okay. We like creepy.
Not on his part, but Wes Craven tried to get a real reaction from him and to get him to really cry. He wanted him to really cry.
Well,
so
yeah.
To do this, his mother would leave the set, and his father would whisper in his ear, "Your mother's dead."
Okay.
And if he cried for the take, he was rewarded a happy meal.
That's kind of extreme, yeah.
That makes you think. I mean, you know, you hear all these horror stories about how child actors were treated in like the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And then this is in the 90s, and they're still doing it.
Well, or it falls into that whole, you know, director manipulation stuff. You know, remember,
exactly.
I think when we did Exorcist, it was talking about how, you know, Friedkin would shoot off guns off stage and everything and freak people out to scare them or startle them or whatever.
Right. Right.
You know, so it's all those manipulations you do. I always remember that movie Stuntman, which I love and think is excellent. And right before the big, huge scene where the lead actress has to break down, Peter O'Toole's character comes and goes, oh, by the way, your parents are here visiting today. And she goes, oh, great. That's great. And she sees them sitting over there. And he goes, but unfortunately, they were in the screening room and we were going through all of your sex scenes. So they saw them all. Okay, action. And walks away. And she starts crying because she's so embarrassed and everything else. And he's going, that's perfect. That's perfect. You know? And it's that kind of, you know, directors do it all the time. I mean, Kubrick did it. Wells did it. You know, as a director, you do what you have to do sometimes. But that seems a little, it seems a little like child abuse.
Exactly. That's what, you know, telling them your mother is dead, you need to cry for the scene, you'll get a happy meal.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty harsh.
Your mother's dead, but we're going to stop at McDonald's on the way to the viewing.
Right.
You know, just for you. Yeah. That's okay. Yeah. So.
Wes Craven obviously played himself.
He did.
Terrible actor.
See, I thought he was fine. He was much better than Shay, and I thought he was better than Julie or Janie, whoever. Right.
Sam Rubin played himself. I'm assuming he's an executive at New Line. I didn't really get any information on him. Robert Shay played himself. Sarah Risher played herself. She's the one that greets Heather in the lobby.
Oh, this says, come on in, get us some coffee.
That's a real executive from, yes. And she even was like so nervous, they said she went out and bought that suit brand new because she wanted to look good. John Saxon obviously played himself. I mentioned Lynn Shay, Robert's wife. That's Bob Shay's wife. Appears as a nurse. She was the teacher reading the, I think, Hamlet scene in Nightmare on Elm Street. And then we get to Robert Englund, who played himself and Freddy Krueger. Robert has gone on record to say that this is his favorite movie of the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise and his favorite makeup for the franchise as well.
Really? It's probably easier to put on, I'm sure, because it looked like a mask.
I bet you're right.
It looked like a mask, so I think it was probably much easier to apply.
Yeah. And I don't know if you noticed, but in the ending credits, Freddy Krueger is credited as himself.
No, I didn't notice that. I missed it. I'm sorry. Yeah. That's good. That's good.
That is pretty much all I have on casting. I have a little bit of awards. Our friends at the Academy of Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror Films and the Saturn Awards nominated this for Best Horror Film. Best Performance by a Young Actor, Miko Hughes, and Best Music. Oh, really? No, it had to be the horror music.
Yeah, the orchestration music, because this had orchestration. The other I remember Nightmare had electronic. Nightmare was, it sounded like a John Carpenter movie.
A little
and
bit,
this one,
maybe.
And this one doesn't. This one has like real orchestration to it.
Real melodramatic orchestration when she's driving around looking for Starsky and Hutch.
Well, that didn't work. Yeah, the Starsky and Hutch doesn't work, but the rest of it works pretty good.
The Fangoria Chainsaw Awards actually gave it two wins, one for Best Actress, Heather Langenkamp, and one for Best Screenplay. I think they're awarding the concept, not the screenplay.
Right.
The concept is brilliant.
Especially the concept pre-Scream. This was really pushing. This came out, you know, before its time kind of thing to be that meta about a movie that's about a movie, you know, kind of thing. It was just
a major franchise villain. Yeah. Yeah. It was also nominated by Fango for Best Wide Release and Best Supporting Actor, Miko Hughes. And then other than that, it is not on the 1001 movies you must see before you die. However, Scream was, I'm pretty sure. So, like I said, it was like his learning movie to me leading up to Scream. But I just think there's moments of sheer brilliance in this. And most of it has to do with concept.
But. See, it's interesting. We covered Scream, and I thought that. I mean, we gave a lot of credit. I think, if I remember correctly, to Kevin Williamson for the screenplay. I'm wondering how much input Craven actually had. You know, because I think I remember something like it was Williamson went away and wrote it in like 3 days or 5 days or something like that. But I'm wondering how much influence, even in prep of initial idea and all that, Craven had, because a lot of that is in here. This whole
misdirection
of ourselves in the movie. It's just that Scream, of course, is talking about the entire horror genre, not just a particular
genre.
Movie. And this one is you know, I was trying to think. I don't think there's any other franchise that could make fun of itself as well, or multiverse itself as much as Freddy, because it's a nightmare. And when you just said that at the beginning about this is Wes Craven's nightmare, which is literally the plot of the movie.
Right.
I went, oh, duh. That's even in the title. Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah, but you couldn't do this with Jason. You couldn't do this with, Predator. You couldn't do this with any of the other major monsters kind of thing. I don't think you could. Maybe you could do Chainsaw. Because it's become such a cultural icon now. You might be able to do that. Because isn't that the new remake of Chainsaw is about a bunch of people going to look into the Chainsaw murders or into where they were filmed in Texas.
Right. I think the point you're getting at is that it would not be as easy to do it with anything else. Because in the Nightmare on Elm Street movies, you're dealing on a very metaphysical level, I guess, if that's the right terminology.
Right.
It's a very heady type film, whereas Halloween, Friday the 13th, and Texas Chainsaw Massacre all take place in the, quote, real world. This has two worlds, the real world and the dream world. And that overlap is sometimes some of the best parts of these movies, of the Nightmare series, is when those worlds overlap.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and you and I think we covered it on the podcast, but we've talked before. You know, The Shape and Jason are both serial killer monsters. They're boogeymen kind of thing. The thing that makes Freddy so terrifying is he attacks you at your most vulnerable and something you cannot avoid. You cannot not sleep.
Right.
So eventually you're going to face him. You know, you can always, you know, run away from Jason, or at least, you know, he's going to jump in front of you with a weed eater or something.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you can fly to Europe, but you're still going to go to sleep when you're there.
Yeah. You're going to go to sleep, and that's when Freddy will attack, kind of thing. Again, another homage and a good scene I thought was very warm and well done was her saying goodbye to Dylan, saying, don't go to sleep. I'm going to come back. I'm just going to go get Rex. And Julie, don't let him go to sleep. And, you know, she did that same emphatic, it was almost the same inflection of whatever you do, don't fall asleep. And I went, that's just like from the movie. It's perfect.
Yeah. See, if you like that, I think you will really like the first new Halloween movie, because they pay homage so subtly and so uniquely in that movie that it just blew me away. I was loving it. Like I said, she falls out a window and he goes to look down and she's not there. That kind of stuff.
Right.
You know, Lori, that is. And I mean, it's very similar, but I just think they execute it better in that new Halloween movie. But I do love the homages in this movie. I'm with you on that.
Yep.
I've got some trivia before we get to keys, maybe a little too much. One is that, apparently Freddy is depicted much closer to what Wes had envisioned. Shit, I can't speak. Freddy is pictured more to what Wes envisioned for the original movie in this film, more menacing, much less comical. However, before he died, he went on record to say he regrets making the changes. He said we should have left it the way Freddy had looked in those franchise films. He said, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And
Freddy with a ripped sweater and holes and dirt and all of that. And
even
this nice,
if it is the Kevin Yeager makeup, it's more recognizable. Yeah. And he said, agreed, that's the reason he kept the ghost face mask for all the screams. He said, that's, you know, don't, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yeah, like I looked up I think when we were doing Scream or whatever, and I ended up upon like the looks of Jason, and how many different freaking masks and makeup and effects and looks and everything. I was going, well, which one's freaking Jason? Because they all look different.
Well, the makeup definitely changes, but the hockey mask was from the third film on, pretty much.
Yeah, but sometimes it's all beat up, and sometimes it's bright white, and sometimes it's cut in half. Sometimes it has a slash on it, and I'm like, okay. And so, yeah, I agree with Wes. I think it was smart. You know, in the Scream movies, the mask will always look the same. Yeah. It will be the same. Yeah, that was smart.
Yeah, I think so, too. Yeah. What else? The reason that scene I mentioned with Robert Englund on the talk show where everyone's chanting Freddy, that happened to Wes, and that's why it's in the film.
Okay.
He was in San Francisco. There was parents and kids in the audience. Kids all leapt to their feet and started chanting Freddy, Freddy, Freddy. And he said, I remember just looking out there and being horrified by it.
Okay.
So, you know, real life, you know, art imitates real life again. All of the earthquake sequences we mentioned were added later in the film because they were real. I loved all the placement of that. I loved when, like, something wild would happen and you would think, oh, we're getting – this was a very Scream thing where you think you're getting to where, oh, okay, the scare is over. Then, boom, all of a sudden things start shaking and the earthquake comes in. I just love that. I thought he used that really well.
Yep.
And then, okay, and this is what I was going to say about Heather and her husband. Jill Simpson, the assistant to the Outsiders casting director, became close friends with Langenkamp after she was an extra on that film. She also worked as an assistant on Wes Craven's Serpent and the Rainbow and suggested Langenkamp attend a rap party to meet one of the crew members. There, she met her husband, makeup artist David Leroy Anderson. They began a relationship and wed later that year. They had two children together, a son named Daniel, who died in 2018 as the result of a brain tumor, and a daughter named Isabel. I read that, and I immediately went Midnight Club.
Mm-hmm.
She plays the proprietor or whatever of a hospice for terminally ill children. And she had a kid die at the age of 18, and it just knocked the wind out of me. I was like, did Flanagan know this when he cast her in that role?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think?
I don't know. Maybe. Or maybe he had her pull from it.
I'm sure she pulled from it. I mean, it's only been 5 years or 6 years since the kid died.
I had a Heather question, which was, and I noticed in the second scene, and I started to say, okay, maybe I need to go back to Midnight Club and look. But she limps throughout this entire movie. Does Heather Langenkamp herself have a limp?
I don't know. I have no idea.
She limps in this entire movie, yet we don't see her leg or hip or foot or anything injured at any time.
No, so, maybe she does. I mean, I read a wiki page on her before we recorded today because I was looking for information on that stalking case.
Yeah.
And it didn't say anything about a limp that I read.
I was just really curious because, like, even when she tries to run in the fight at the end, she's limping.
Is she limping in Midnight Club? I can't remember.
I don't know. That's why I said I think I have to go back to Midnight Club and watch and see. But I also can't remember any time she ran or moved fast in Midnight Club. Everything was her at the desk, her walking slowly down the hallway talking to people.
Right.
You know, that kind of thing.
That's what I was thinking too.
But yeah, I may have to go back and research or look because that's a question I just had. If you guys are out there listening to us or watching us and know, let us know. I'd love to know. Does Heather Langenkamp have a real, actual physical issue?
Right. Yeah. Maybe she does.
Yeah.
And then that's all the trivia I had, but I just found that fascinating.
I did too. I thought when you said she had a son that died, I mean, I thought, ooh, that probably played a lot into this.
And to die so near, I mean, first of all, she had a stalking case in real life. And this movie, she has a stalker. Now she's playing the proprietor of a place for terminally ill kids, and she had a kid die in 2018 of a brain tumor. It's like people keep casting her in these real life roles. And I'm like, you know, I mean, I like
she's going to end up messed up.
You know? Yeah. Well, she can pull from it, and obviously she doesn't, she's not opposed to it. So maybe it's good. It could be good therapy for her. Who knows?
So, well, before Keys, I have my few questions for you. So okay. I didn't really understand Dylan. Is Freddie possessing Dylan, or is Dylan like a gateway or something? I think they really, again, another miss because they didn't explain that, because it's stated several times that Dylan has not slept. He is suffering from sleep deprivation. But there are times when he vomits all over her, or he suddenly uses Freddie's voice, or he does the chant, or he tapes up knives to his fingers. So I didn't get the concept, because I don't think it was ever explained, because at the end, he's suddenly a hero. And so I was confused. That's just not really a question I have, because I don't think you have an answer. It's just a question.
I don't have a concrete answer. I have my theory.
Yeah.
And it's very much the same as with the earthquakes. I feel like as Wes is working on this project, everything's culminating to this demon coming through, including the earthquakes that are occasionally shaking the land. And I feel that this is just, like you said, maybe he is a gateway. And that is the way they're playing Heather's story in the film, because in the original movie, she's a child of the parents that murdered Freddy Krueger. In this movie, Freddy Krueger's going after her real life kid, or quote, Freddy Krueger, the demon, what have you.
Right.
So, I mean, my theory is that all of that is starting to manifest in signs and symbolism or actions. And I think the earthquake and Dylan would be part of that.
Okay. Okay.
Does that make sense?
I can accept that. Yep. Makes sense. Okay. Where are all the TV clips coming from? Are they coming from Freddie? If coming from Freddie, why is he giving her clues? I didn't understand
what TV clips?
All the you know, every time the television comes on, it's either her movie or it's some news article about the two guys that were killed, or about the earthquakes, or you know. And I was going, why would Freddie want her to know this knowledge? It was just a that's a rhetorical question. It did make sense to me.
Well, I mean, the only thing I picked up on is that in some of those clips, things look like Freddy. Like the Geiger, what do you call it? Is it a Geiger counter that measures earthquakes?
Yes. Okay. Well, a Geiger counter is a radioactivity.
What is
a seismograph?
A seismograph. All right. Yeah. When it says earthquake watch or whatever down at the corner of the newscast, instead of just up and down, the lines are slightly curved like Freddy blades. And I was like, well, that's interesting. When she has the nightmare on the set or whatever, and she looks and sees Dylan on a bed, and all of a sudden a mattress goes by, and when the two guys roll. It's like a flat or whatever, movie flat. They roll it past, and as soon as it's past, he's disappeared. The guy rolling it past is wearing a red and green striped sweater. It's dark, and you can't hardly see it, but it's there. I mean, he was putting all these little homages in there, or little teasers or hints or what have you.
Right. I also read in one that, like, when she and John Saxon are on the bench talking, and you know Dylan's doing his spaceship climb or whatever, kid drives by on a bicycle in the back, and he has the Freddy sweater on.
I think I read that too. Yeah, I didn't catch it. Easter egg. That's another scene that I didn't mention, but hell, man, that scene's very memorable.
Yeah, good tension. But
Holy cow.
You know, but it's one of my keys too. We'll get to it, but I have a key for that scene, of course. But would a kid really climb into an oven or a bricked in kind of place that has a fire in it? I don't think he would. That would just seem weird. And if you're Freddy and you're afraid of fire because fire killed you, these parents set you on fire, and why would you have fire all over your temple? everywhere. It makes, I don't know why this would be here other than a set piece for Hansel and Gretel. It just made no, that just bugged me to death. And I was going, okay,
I think it was, again, I think it was just homage to the first film because he was always in the boiler room and there was always fires yeah. and stuff. And they didn't want to make it a boiler room because they were trying to be more universal as far as this demon. Right. So they made it like a temple or whatever.
That makes sense.
I think that was all just, what's the word? Not cinematography, but art direction.
Yeah. The other question, some of these already covered, which is, you know, who was asleep at the funeral? Why didn't they kill Robert Englund? If you're going to mention this demon and give it all these particulars, why not give it a name or some kind of visual or something to do? Agreed. And then my last one is kind of terrible, but I wrote down, okay, is it really bad that I feel more for Rex than I do for Dylan or Heather? And it was like, when they sliced up Rex, I was like, oh, no. But then when they're killing Julie and doing all this.
Together, he looked like a little Frankenstein Rex.
I loved that. But then they, you know, later on, Freddie totally rips him up and kills him. Totally. And, you know. And
yeah, so, I didn't have a lot of sympathy for Dylan because he was kind of obnoxious to me. I had sympathy for Heather, though. I did have sympathy for her.
Yeah. Well, I did in places, but a lot more. I mean, I had a lot more emotional sympathy because I knew she was Final Girl, so it was okay. But I had a lot more sympathy for Rex because Rex was just trying to protect everybody and Freddie got him.
I don't know if I have it in my notes because I would have normally put this in trivia. But I think this is the lowest body count of any Freddy film. I think only 4 people die in this movie.
Well, the father, 2 special effects guys, Julie.
And that's it.
Yeah, that's it.
I think that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wait, before that, you reminded me of something, though, and now I've forgotten it. Shoot.
Well, we were talking about sympathy for Heather. That's
sympathy
a good name.
For the Heather.
That's the new Rolling Stones song, Sympathy for Heather.
Sympathy for Heather. Yeah.
Please allow me to introduce myself.
Yeah.
I was in Nightmare on Elm Street.
5.
Chain.
9. Yeah, whatever. I did like her hair turning. I thought that was a great touch.
Oh yeah,
as well.
I was going to mention that too. That's another one of those little homages with her hair going gray.
And I think that's what I was trying to get to. That you reminded me of an homage I didn't even have in my notes that I really liked, and now I can't remember what it was. But it was another moment that was really good. It wasn't an homage at all. It was original and really great. The descent down the bed to hell, that was great.
With the pit, where she's going through the sheets and it's like a tunnel and it just keeps going on and on. And he leaves little sleeping pills like breadcrumbs and the whole Hansel and Gretel allegory. Yeah.
Yep. Loved
that.
Yeah,
I like that
Thought
too.
That was brilliant. And that was really cool. And the way it transitioned from the sheets and a bed to like a, you know, Die Hard air duct tunnel thing, and then suddenly she's falling through water, and that was really good. That was nice. Yeah.
That leads me to a couple of things. One that just kind of jarred me and took me out of it was she gets mad at him for watching Nightmare on Elm Street, and then she's reading him Hansel and Gretel, which is just as creepy.
Oh, yeah.
She's very like, much I don't understand why you like this stuff. And he all of a sudden knows the end and reads it to her from verbatim from his mind.
And at the end, she's reading him the screenplay. I was going,
right.
Okay, in a couple of scenes, you're going to be really sad when it gets to the kill his daddy part. I don't think you're going to want to read that to him.
She's trying to keep that demon away by that movie being made.
Keep him in the story. Keep him in the story. Yeah.
And then, now I've lost my train of thought, but back to the doctor, says something about Freddy Krueger and accuses her, oh, so you have shown him your movies. And she looks right at that doctor and just, everyone knows who Freddy Krueger is.
Oh, yeah. She even says he's
like. Great line.
And the next one was like, he's like Santa Claus or King Kong or whatever.
He's Santa Claus or King Kong.
Perfect. Yes, everybody, every kid knows who Freddy is. Right. Don't go to sleep.
Yeah. I mean, that is as brilliant to me as the commentary that of Wes showing the maniacal people in the audience of the talk show. I just was like, this is just great social commentary. Great, 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 great.
Yeah. Really good. And even before that, the interviewer's questions to her about how does Dylan feel about your movie? And blah, blah, that intrusive kind of interviewer that is asking the inappropriate questions. That was
The limo driver. The limo driver that's so creepy. And you were that girl in that movie. That was cool when he killed all those people. Your friend, Tina, or whatever. Yeah.
Right.
And you know what? I neglected to mention, I thought it was in my notes, but it's not. But I think the girl that played Tina was asked to come back. But that she couldn't. I want to say she was.
Oh, man, that would have been good too.
I think she was on a soap opera, maybe filming in New York or something. I don't know. She was not available though. But they, I mean, everybody was asked except for Johnny Depp, who said he would have done it. So, all right. Keys.
Yeah, see, that would have been okay. Talk about meta of meta. She should have been Julie, the real actress, and named the real actress, and they've been friends since the movie, and that's why she still comes over and helps Heather babysit. And then she gets killed in the hospital the same way Tina did.
She would have been much older, but
she would have been much older, but that's fine. Yeah. It doesn't, you know, she would have been the same age as Heather.
I would have rather seen Angelina Jolie.
Well, I would too, but we didn't get her because she wasn't big enough yet, and Winona couldn't do it.
Well, you're saying this girl was big then? I don't think so.
Well, no, but that's what I mean. We should have been able to get her. She wasn't big, you know?
No, I'm talking about the girl that played her in real life.
Yeah, yeah.
The one that you don't like.
Oh, no. No, get rid of her. You know, I don't know what she did after this, but I bet it wasn't good either. I'm just saying. She's just not very good.
All right. Keys.
Keys. My first key would be Scream, just because it is definitely a key to this movie. Obviously, we've talked about enough on this to everybody know, but definitely Scream. My next one is
deeper than that.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously the whole premise of being very meta is Scream, but the phone calls and the voice on the phone. Is that the same guy? I mean, it sounded like
I don't know, but
guy.
It could have been. Yeah, yeah, that's a good point.
Because,
good
you know, he was Heather has a stalker in the movie that's calling her and saying ugly things on the phone. And it sounds just like the guy from Scream.
Yep.
And so every time the phone rings, you jump in this movie. Very much like Scream.
My second one is The Omen. Not only is Dylan a little Damien-like in a couple of these scenes, but I would, again, rewriting, you know, things that people have done, I would have had him say, "Mommy, look at me," when he's at the top of the spaceship, because that reminded me directly of Omen and the nurse up there and everything else going, "Watch this, Damien.
It's all for you.
It's all for you."
"Mommy, it's all for you." And she catches him. That's why she has a limp. That's exactly why she has a limp.
See, and
that would be very hard.
That would be hard. Yeah, that would be very hard. I have Pet Sematary, yep.
And it's not because of the fact that it's the kid that played Gage in Pet Sematary. It's because of that funeral scene I was talking about. Anytime there is a traumatic funeral scene in a movie, I think of the book Pet Sematary, where the father-in-law is fighting with the son and they tip the casket over and the boy's body spills out, or they get a glimpse of the body flashing or something. That whole scene reminded me of Pet Sematary.
Yeah, when I think Pet Sematary, I don't think of Gage so much. I think of those kind of scenes. I think of that one. I think of the horror when Gage is first killed. I think of the Pascal stuff at the hospital.
That
and
was
suddenly,
awful.
You know, that's just good. But anyway,
the wife returning at the end.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the heel dragging on the floor as she enters the
house. She's coming. Yeah.
They need to make a good version.
Man, We should watch that one again. I haven't watched that in
forever. It's on our list. The original, yeah.
Yeah, of course. With, sometimes things come by.
No, you know, dead is better.
Dead is better. Dead is better.
Too many movies in my head. That's going to be my phrase for 2023 because I've already said it. I think I said it on the Superman episode I was listening to recently.
Yep.
I was like, how many movies are in my head? Help me.
I've got the Spielberg shot, of course, the Jaws Spielberg shot because he uses that when she sees the cops at the door. That rack focus zoom.
The zoom pullback thing.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've got Misery, another Stephen King.
Oh, wow. What do you think about Misery?
As soon as Gabe lays back and everything else and then reaches in and pulls out that pill, all I could think of was Misery because he puts it under the pillow too. And I was going, oh, man, that's Misery right there.
Well, and it was like, again, overacting on the kid. It was not subtle at all. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. But that's not the only... I mean, Misery is definitely the reference that we'll use as far as a key, but that's not the only film I've seen that in. I've seen that before in
multiple
films, I think.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I've got The Exorcist and in parentheses, Vomit.
Of course.
Where is that? I can't even remember. But it's somebody when Gabe
when Freddy says, I'm almost here, and it's in literally Freddy's voice coming out of Dylan, and then he vomits all over Mom.
He just sprays vomit in her face. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And it disappears within like 30 seconds.
Oh, it does.
Totally gone and not there on her anymore.
You're obviously paying more attention than me.
Well, I think I was so into trying to see clues and see stuff. Are we in a dream? Are we not in a dream? What's happening? That sort of thing.
Yeah.
So I was really perceptive of this movie, I think.
I have Nosferatu.
I have that next. Yep.
That's so funny that ours are in progression as we were watching the movie. And it's the shadow of the glove on the wall.
Yeah. The shadow moving. It was so Nosferatu. I was going, that's
very
awesome.
F. That's Murnau, really good. Or F. Whatever his name is, Murnau. Yeah.
Uh huh.
And then you mentioned Buffy.
Yep. I have that next.
I had not thought of that. The Hellmouth. That's really kind of cool. I just never even thought.
And it was around the same time. It was the 90s. So that's Buffy. It's Buffy time. Yeah. I have Hansel and Gretel, of course. We mentioned that already. And this is that's a huge allegory for it. The whole breadcrumb thing, the plant at the beginning when they're reading it. And then, of course, the how do we defeat the demon is the same way they defeated the witch. But I also have Last Action Hero. Because wasn't that where the film character actually came to life?
Yeah.
Came into reality?
I mean, I haven't seen it, but I think that's what it is.
Okay. So again, I think that's a movie that this influenced in bringing your cinema character to life, kind of thing.
Right. You mentioned Scream as your first one, but my major one is obviously all of the Nightmare on Elm Street movies, because one of the things we've talked about the most in this episode is the homages to the original film.
Yeah.
So anything, I mean, and you could even, I'll even put this in there. Back in the 80s, there was a show called Freddy's Nightmares that was like an anthology show. I haven't seen it in forever. I can't even remember if it's any good.
Wow.
But do you remember that?
Vaguely.
Robert Englund hosted it.
Very vaguely.
Yeah, he hosted it as Freddy. And it was like Tales from the Dark Side. You know, they would just do a couple of stories in an episode or whatever. Short stories. So Freddy's Nightmares as well. And then what else do I have? The basic premise of the film, Freddy invading a real world and haunting the actors, was originally intended for Nightmare on Elm Street 3, inspired by the movie Return to Horror High. I lifted this from IMDb because I've never seen Return to Horror High, but it was rejected by the studio at the time. And I went and read the synopsis of Return to Horror High. And it is about the events of like a Jason Friday the 13th thing being filmed And as the film is being made, the actors start getting killed, like the people they're basing the movie on.
Okay.
So even though I've never seen it, I was like, well, yeah, I need to list this because
what was the name again?
It's called Return to Horror High.
Okay.
Like okay. High school, I guess.
Yeah.
And it's a movie within a movie or them making a movie about something that happened and then all of a sudden it really starts happening. That.
Well, I vaguely remember one that came out. It's like a shoot. I'm not sure when it came out but it was. It's called like Final Girl or The Final Girls.
There is one called or Final whatever. Girls, I think, or Final Girl.
I remember one was called Final Girl, and I remember it had like Abigail Breslin or somebody in it, but it was really good. But it was basically a girl who became a murderer. But then there was one called Final Girls or The Final Girl or whatever. And anyway, and it's like Scream. It's a bunch of friends talking about not being the final girl and they slowly start dying one by one, like in Jason.
And them being the final girl is actually the good thing.
I guess they're fighting to be the final girl maybe or something. I don't know.
I have one last key that's a potential key because it doesn't exist yet.
Okay.
Did you have any others?
No. Doesn't exist yet. I'm curious about though.
Rumor has it that there is some talk going on right now about a reboot of Nightmare on Elm Street. Very similar to what they did with Halloween and what they're doing this year with The Exorcist and Ellen Burstyn with that second Exorcist or new Exorcist movie. Right. You know what I'm talking about? You're the one that talked about it.
Yeah. I remember because I'm dreading it with horror.
Well, I'm curious. I mean, that one I think is done by the same guy that did Halloween. The one that's being talked about with Freddy Krueger, no one's attached that I know of yet, but Heather Langenkamp has already said, oh yeah, I'm in. And I tell you what, I think they should get Robert Englund. Fuck recasting him. I mean, there's no reason why Robert Englund couldn't play that role again.
No, especially after seeing him in, what was it? Bly Manor? What was it? What was he in recently? Stranger Things. That was it. He was great in that. Mm-hmm. He's really good.
No, he's a great actor. It requires makeup, so you are not going to see that he's aged. So
no, I think it's not fine. At all. Do it. Yeah.
So maybe my last key is they'll do it again, and they'll get the gang back together, even though Wes Craven and John Saxon are dead, and Ronnie Blakely, Heather's mom. For those of you out there that are not watching on YouTube, we just lit cigarettes very exaggeratedly.
Very exaggeratedly, I don't smoke, sort of. Yeah, sort of thing. Anyway.
Freddie can't get you, darling, because mommy killed him.
Mommy killed him. Well, thank you all for listening to us go through one of Tim's favorite iconic monsters of all time. Absolutely. And getting our opinions on it. We would love to hear your opinions on it. So what did you think? Did you like New Nightmare? Should it still be Wes Craven's New Nightmare? What do we think about these plot holes or these things about it, but also the kind of meta prior to Scream? Everybody praises Williamson and Scream so much, but hey, this seems to have predated it sort of thing and been a key for it. If you do like us, want to talk about us, we'd love to get a review from you. Even if it's a short one, you just say, hey, great job, guys, or something like that. Any little bit helps. Please do subscribe, rate us, comment, tell us good things or bad things if you have them, whatever. You can email us. You can go to johnnyhasthekeys.com and watch all of our past shows. We also have a Patreon as well. If you want to support the show and keep us going, doing this lovely, fun stuff, then you can do that. And we do special things for our patrons there. We have two other podcasts that we do. One is The X-Files Declassified, which is about the classic X-Files series. And then we have The Dilithium Chamber, which is our Star Trek, the original series. We're deep diving into each of those episodes. And Tim, thanks again for doing this. I love it each and every week. And, well, I'm sure I'll see you next week when we'll either be afraid or we'll be, you know, somewhere.
We're in outer space and it's a foreign film. It's a foreign film.
Wait, I picked a foreign science fiction film.
Oh, yeah.
I know which one you're talking about. It's a good one. It's good. You'll like it. All right. Okay. I hope you'll like it, but we'll see. All right. See you next week.
All right. Take care.
Bye.